Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Dean Zimmerman, ACE, about editing director Sean Levy's film, Free Guy. Dean's been a guest on Art of the Cut before for his editing of Stranger Things, for which he won an Emmy and was nominated for an Ace Eddie. I've also spoken with his brother Dan about cutting the feature film Maze Runner. Dean's previous credits as editor go back to Rush Hour 3 in 2007. He also cut Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian, and Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, Gulliver's Travels, Real Steel, The Internship, and The Darkest Minds, among many others. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. Dean and I will be discussing several clips from the show, and you'll be able to see them right there.
Tell me about how your relationship started with a director.
We started almost 20 years ago together, his second commercial studio film, Just Married. We connected in a monster way, and he had then kind of went off and did two other movies, Two Year by the Dozen and Pink Panther. Our schedules didn't align at that point, reunited again for Night at the Museum 1. Since Night at the Museum 1, I've cut everything he's ever done since.
Tell me a little bit about his collaboration method, your collaboration method. How do you guys work in the editing room?
It's been such a growing process for so long. I was saying this yesterday. We were talking about a scene, and before he even was saying, oh, I want to try this. And I was like, oh, you want to try it like this? And he's like, literally, you're in my head. And I said, I know. It's scary. We are friends outside of work as well as inside of work. My collaboration is probably more than most. He definitely really relies on me. I 100% rely on him for anything. He trusts me implicitly. I do the same. And he knows that I only have his best interest at heart and put his vision on the screen. And so that's what we just do every day. So when he does get a script, he'll send it to me, I'll read it. He'll ask my opinions, my thoughts, my issues, concerns, any of that. I voice it and he then will make a decision whether he wants to move forward and develop that or not. And it's not for every single project that he's got, because he is such a mogul now that he's literally doing 40 things at once.
Do you find that most of your notes, if you provide them, are structural related or story related?
Mostly story and character related. A lot of the times Sean has an idea of who he wants to play certain characters. So when I read it, I have those people in my mind and I kind of go, I don't know if that's going to be right for that person. It's little things like that. And it's one of those things where it's almost like he needs this isn't working for me to go, okay, we're not going to do that.
With people like Taika, and I would even think Ryan Reynolds, that there's probably a lot of ad-libbing. Is that correct?
Not as much as Taika. Taika, we let the dog loose. It was like he was performing a masterclass in ad-lib. The speed at which he comes up and some of the stuff that just comes out of his mouth is so insanely ridiculous, but so in character, and so smart. He's one of the fastest people I've ever, and I worked with a lot of the big giants out there, and Taika definitely holds his own to any one of the old greats, because there was such an abundance of material. It was, how do we make sure that what we're putting on the screen is super funny, but still in character, and doesn't betray anything to the story? If there was any kind of work that needed to get in there and massage a bit, was the Taika character. We found it right away. I always try to put in all the jokes and all the ad-libs for Sean, at least for the initial run and viewing of it, so that he can go, okay, I like that joke, I don't like that joke, blah, 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 blah. With Taika, we loved all of them. So it's like, well, why don't we just try to keep them in there and see what audiences tell us? And what they really kind of told us is, we love it all, but it's too much. When you get too much, it starts detracting from his story and it starts detracting from his power as the villain. And so you've got to really find that delicate balance of letting him be funny and just crazy ostentatious, but also believable in this savvy business guy.
How do you deal with all that ad-libbing in your bin or as you edit? Are you pulling selects? Do you use Script Sync? Tell me how you find those.
I use the Frame View as my bins for any initial cut. I've got a weird photographic memory, if you will. So in my little window, there's a little timeline underneath, and I have markers for any kind of reset, but I also have different color markers for ad libs and just stuff that's off script. And I kind of memorize where certain things are, reactions and stuff like that. So when I go back, I can quickly and just jump to spots right away. I do love Scripter, and it's great for running lines and just showing him all the different alt performances of a single line. But I'm kind of old school in the sense of I need to see the tile. And I know Scripter has it in there and it stays there, but it's too small for these old lines now.
So it sounds also like you don't use a selects reel.
I watch every frame of dailies from literally before Clapper to as far as it goes, and then it stops. There's many times that I've used stuff prior to slate rolling. Perfect example, in Real Steel, we used Hugh Jackman sitting in a car at the fairground trying to get into an emotional state. He was listening to a song that was, he was remembering his dad. He was starting to get into this emotional state. Then they put the Clapper in, he drove the truck. Well, we basically took that pre-slate him doing that, and we put that at the end of his drive so we could have this emotional beat, and we put some VFX of the fairground going on in the background of the windshield. Actually, that was a Steven Spielberg pitch, because he was watching dailies and saw that and said that would be great to incorporate in somehow, and we were able to. And it was one of the things where you never know where you're going to find the beautiful nuggets of performance. So I watch everything, and then as I start to build it, I'll remember where the different ad-libs that I think I can incorporate in, because some don't always work. You know, I mean, you have a structure of a scene, you have the script of a scene, and how far you deviate from that will depend on what ad-libs you can use and not. You know, some never make it. Most, sometimes all of them make it. It's a feel thing for me. It's also a pacing thing for me. So if I can make it work where it doesn't hurt the pace of a scene, I'll do it. But if it's starting to feel a little like we're indulging a little too much, then I'll start to pare it down. But I don't necessarily have like a selects bin now.
Tell me about trying to edit with what must have been a massive amount of green screen and previs.
There was a lot of green screen, but you know, I'm used to it. For me, the biggest challenge is making sure that the pace and the performances are true. I know what it's going to ultimately look like, and I have a vision of in my head what's going to be. The hardest part for me, especially in something like this, where sometimes it's a full CG shot. Now, where am I going to put that? And where does that go? When you have nothing, the environment's all CG, the characters are all CG. It's a very unique environment. So we rely on a post-viz team that will kind of do a cartoon animation of it. It really is a unique talent to be able to make something that doesn't exist great in stuff that's supposed to concurrently go together with live action. So I love using this term, and I use this integrated editorial, right? And that is a multifaceted term that I use because it applies to not only just visual effects, which is super important nowadays, but it also is with music and sound as well. So with music, I use the same music editor on most of my projects. And Sean will always use Craig Hennigan, who's been our sound designer forever. And all those pieces are tools that I'm using to make not only myself look good, but obviously them. But like, so I'll give Craig rough stuff and I'll say, just give me some cool sounds, because sometimes his sounds will dictate how long I stay in a shot. And then it will also inspire me to then go to visual effects and go, I need this. So it was just all this stuff inspired all of us to elevate the scene to the next level. And we did. It was very challenging, but it was so much fun. It was one of those things where we were so fortunate on most Sean Levy films to have an abundance of resources, but also just the willingness to let us run wild a little bit. Yeah, we'll rein in with some budget stuff. But at the end of the day, if we present something that's even better, it's usually met with such support. And it really was, especially on Free Guy, we were able to do so much. And it was one of those things where they're like, they saw the potential, they fell in love with it, as we all did immediately. And so the willingness and the wantingness to make it as big as it is was there, and the appetite was there, and we were hungry. We were in COVID and sitting at home starving, so we just kind of came up with how to make it better.
You mentioned getting sounds in. Was it something that you got a little toolkit before you even started editing dailies, or were you just getting sounds in once you'd got a scene cut?
I mean, just like I said, working with Craig for as long as we have, I do have a fairly large toolkit. So I definitely utilize that. But Craig is such an artist. He likes to do everything from scratch. So really mine is just a template and a roadmap for him, a blueprint, if you will.
How quickly are you stripping in actual sound design from him, or do you not do that until the end?
So I do it as I cut. So I'll cut a scene and I'll have one of my assistants do a rough pass of sound. And usually I do all the music. Like, I'm not great at music, but what I am good at is knowing what tone of score needs to be. If you ask me to pick a song, like in Free Guy, that is not me. That 100% was Ryan Reynolds and Sean Levy.
Tell me about some of the changes or how the movie evolved from the original assembly as you guys started to hone the picture.
If I had to give a percentage, we were 85% on editor's cut. You know, I have the best text ever from Ryan Reynolds. It was when the movie released on Friday night, texted me late night, and he said, "Congrats on an amazing Free Guy review, my friend. So well deserved. You had that sucker firing on all cylinders before I even sat down in the chair. Working with you is such a gift. I'll never take it for granted. Lots of love to you and the whole family."
Wow. And so do you remember editor's cut length?
Yeah, we started at about 148.
148. And wait, what was it last night? What did I see?
You saw 130, web on 130.
Wow, 10 minutes. That's incredible. One of the things that I noticed was that it's almost kind of a Groundhog's Day thing. And I loved how each day was slightly different.
Everything's intentional in editing. There's always a reason for you picking a certain performance and you picking a certain thing. For Free Guy, it was, I didn't want it to be boring. But also, as Guy was starting to, through his AI, become more sentient, things need to change a little bit, right? His view of the world changes. So in that, we needed to show different sides of him. You know, Ryan's one of the best collaborators I've ever experienced. I mean, he really not only knows what he wants, but he's so just willing to engage in any kind of creative development. It's great.
Was he in the edit suite?
He was welcomed. Sean offered and came in. And it was really more 3 days of us just watching the movie and laughing and having fun. And or going like, how do we make this better? You know, I mean, he's got such great ideas. And again, because he's such a prolific writer, having that resource in the cutting room, it just doesn't get any better.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the dynamics of not just having it be nonstop wall to wall and taking a moment, feeling the emotion, being quiet for a moment, being slower for a moment?
It's a really good question, because in comedy, if every scene is super funny, you get fatigue. Same with action, right? If you have too many action sequences together, you get set fatigue or action fatigue. The preview process really helps us gauge where that fatigue is and be able to do something about it. Do very informal friends and family screenings prior to taking it out into the world to kind of work through those issues if there are any, or we're feeling there could potentially be any. With Free Guy, we wanted it to be those moments of unabashedly onslaught of video game and just eye candy everywhere and just so much stuff happening. But then we have those beautiful moments of quiet where he's just sitting in his apartment, or he wakes up and says good morning to his fish. Or they take a nice little walk on the water with Jody. There were some great moments of just that kind of calm. And what we found is audiences nowadays, they really want to just be on this ride. And the tolerance of how long those quieter moments or the intimate moments can be is really where you have to sculpt and find it with audience reactions and stuff like that.
When you are dealing with so many layers of effects and plates and all the green
screen. I love this question so much.
Go for it. Tell me about how you deal with this.
This is one of my favorite questions anyone has ever asked me. So I think for me, I will politely and very definitively tell my assistants, if you do more than 7 video tracks and 18 audio tracks, we're in another problem. If you can't fit it into that, you shouldn't be my assistant. And so I just don't feel like there's any need for anything more, right? Like with technology today, recall is so easy. Really the reason why for me, because I'm such a visual person. And again, I told you kind of this weird photographic thing, my timeline, I need to see all the tracks. If I have to scroll, something's going to get messed up. I hate that. I won't even start cutting and see if I go in to fix a project or something and I go into there and I'm like, nope, I won't even go in and touch anything unless at the most, there's 10 video tracks and 18 audio tracks. I like to see all my layers in front of me when I edit, so I can see where things need to be pushed and pulled and dragged out. The more movement you have to do on your mouse, the more clicks you have to make, the slower you're going to be. So if I can have everything right then and there, I don't have to use my finger to scroll up and down or click over to the bar to drag it up and down or zoom in, zoom out. I actually work so much more efficiently just having all my tracks labeled how I want them. I also color code. So everything's color coded. Everything has a different color. So I know exactly what is what and where it is.
Do you color code the tracks or the clips or both?
Both.
What do you color code?
So Temp Visual Effects are green. Avid Visual Effects are brown. Dailies are gray. ADR is yellow. Music is blue. And there's different shades, obviously. Sound effects are orange. So it's beautiful because it actually is very colorful on my timeline. It's great. But again, it's just such a quick reference for me visually when I'm cutting to go, oh, you want to hear the ADR? And I can go, okay, there it is. And again, it's all about speed and efficiency.
I just want to show you a couple of scenes. I think I kind of have them in order of the way they are in the movie. So I'm going to start out with this scene, which I'm going to share my screen so you can see it.
There's so many little things that are happening in the background. The 98 cent store instead of the 99 cent store. It's just doing an homage to certain things. These are all just the little Easter eggs that we keep putting in. This is kind of where we were really like tapping into our video game resources that we had, the experts, and going, you know, what Easter eggs would you like, guys love to see, that kind of stuff. So, you know, picking skins on cars as they're driving by, the ATA walker walking by, you know, just nods to different video games. The absurdity of this is his, he gets thrown through the window every day. This is his normal life. And he just gets back up and is like, yeah, Mondays. All right. See you later. Also, just the simplicity of coffee is just a cup that's labeled coffee. In a couple of the other scenes, you'll see like a trash can. All you see is just hundreds of the red cups in there that say coffee. And even when we go to the coffee store behind the barista, it's not like latte, cappuccino. It's hot coffee, really hot coffee. Super hot coffee. Like there's one order for everyone.
Because the idea is that this guy's not really part of the story.
Exactly. He's just a background player that is ultimately going to get robbed 350 times a day. And that's just his life. When he first puts on the glasses, we have the heads up display. The world changes. Now we're in the video game. But this shot in particular, when you watch it behind him, you're going to see these radical camera moves as if you're in a video game and you can change your perspective or your view. This camera move is completely unachievable with a normal camera.
It kind of goes through his head. You're looking at what he's looking at, and then all of a sudden you're behind him. So it starts as POV, and then it goes looking at him, looking at the scene.
It kind of wraps around him, this fast wrap around, and then all these kind of moves are done with this very special camera. It's brand new technology that we kind of broke on the show. Basically what it is if you've ever been to or seen clips of cars being put together, you know those big robot arms that grab big pieces of steel and slam them onto the car and then get bolted on? That is what we were using. It was a robot arm from a assembly line car manufacturer that they strapped a camera to and developed this program to be able to have this arm move in a way where we can simulate camera moves from a video game. We did have it as like this big one shot, but there was parts that we wanted to slow down. One of the problems with the cameras, you had to program it. It took forever to program it.
For people that are listening and not watching, there's a scene where he sees the med pack, and then it looks like it zooms through the back of his head, but it's actually the camera just must get close to him, and then it's a real fast wipe dissolve into what he's seeing. Man, I gotta tell you, I missed like 100 edits in this when I watched it.
It's all about the art of the invisible edit, right? The eye candy, if you will, all the little different things help us draw the eye into a different spot where we can do these tricks of the trade, if you will, and sleight of hand. And it's how we can get stuff done. This sequence was a really fun one. And a lot of people miss the fact that the two children playing the bank robber are two of Sean's four daughters.
So this is the scene where the two cops first confront Ryan's character now that he's turned from a non-playable character to an actual character in the video game.
It was one of the first times we see real gamers in the real world enter the video game as characters, right? So the scene that precedes this is Ukarsh and Jokiri characters, Mouser and Keith, sitting at their computers. And we actually reshot Joe at his computer picking his skin because it was one of those things when we got into post, one of the notes that we were like is, oh, how, you know, is there confusion of what's happening and why these two guys are this way in the game, but not in real life. And it's like, no, no, they're picking their skin. These are different characters that you can pick in this video game in particular. This is really kind of setting up and again, reinforcing the narrative of these are characters in a video game. These aren't real people. And just distinguishing that there's a real world and a video world for the audience.
This is the scene where he meets Jodie Comer's character for the first time. And what I didn't realize until I watched the clip, there is slow-mo, but you're still trying to sync her singing. So there's a music thing that she's singing to, but then it goes into slow-mo, so you can't have it be in sync, but you kind of did it. She's been through the scene so many times, she even knows what the people on the street are saying.
Everyone has their little catchphrase, and she's singing her, she's in her own little world singing fantasy, and it just happened to be that Ryan catches her singing it and hears it. We start the slow-mo here. This was all just a timing thing. The quick edit is just enough where it's slow-mo, but we can flip sync here and there, just work. And so it was definitely a dance between, and again, this integrated editorial I keep talking about, having our music editor, Dan DePrima, and me just work. This was one of those things where it's like, we kind of went back and forth a little bit. He's like, a couple more frames. And he would sit next to me in the editing room and go, just a couple more. And we could just trim it and then it was like, well, can you just slow it down, like a little, stretch it a little bit, so that people don't know. And so that's kind of what we did.
This is the Glock in your pocket scene.
So there are a few interesting things in here. One is that it is not Jodie doing the flip. We actually had a stunt person do her flip, and we actually digitally put Jodie's face onto the stunt double. This is a scene that got really blocked out. The interesting part about this entire stash house, it was so complicated, but all those cars in there are actually real. The one car that Jodie's behind prior to this little part of the scene, but there's a blue race car in there. That is a real $1 million race car. It was one of those things where it's like, you know, don't get too close to the race car. The unique thing about this whole sequence is it was so choreographed that as they started to shoot, Sean would call me from set and go, we're going to change this and da da da. And is this going to work? And I was like, well, I don't know. I mean, I got to see the footage. And he goes, well, maybe too late. So what we actually ended up doing is I went to set. We put up an easy up tent on set, just right outside the wall of this. We hooked my Avid into the camera and I was live capturing the footage as they were shooting it into my Avid. And I was cutting live on set so that we could make sure that if we needed something or whatever, we could get it right then and there.
Because you were capturing live on set, I'm assuming that there was no metadata, there was nothing, and you had to iMatch that stuff back in when you actually got the digitized footage?
We had the metadata from the actual camera. We were kind of using the Video Assist proxy file. A long story short, yes, we didn't have to iMatch. We did have a time code reference in the metadata, but we couldn't auto-conform it. We did the similar thing on Real Steel where we were capturing live off the camera.
Dean, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Anytime. So I really appreciate it.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. That's where you'll be able to see all the clips that Dean and I were just talking about. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Experience. Thanks to my guest, Dean Zimmerman, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember, if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.